to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to a Catch Them Doing Something Good edition of Answers for the Family. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. One of the things about this show is that we are trying to bring you things that will help not only raise your family, but be able to look at other people's situation and see what it is that we can learn from it. I am really thrilled today to have as my special guest Jim Moray, a journalist for well over two decades who is currently the chief correspondent for Inside Edition, which is based in Los Angeles. Jim was with CNN for nearly a decade, serving as co-anchor of the long-running Showbiz Today, as well as co-anchor of CNN's main newscast, The World Today. He was guest anchor for Larry King Live and anchor of CNN's Newsnight. Our topic today is Jim's new book, The Last Day of My Life. And before I bring Jim up, I just want to share with everybody that I appreciate the calls, I appreciate the emails, and I was really surprised, but we got a lot of comments, and I'm going to post some of those to Jim once we get here. Jim, are you on the line? Jim, do we have you on the line? All right. While we wait for him to come up, I just want to share with everybody that Jim's book is where he talks about the fact that his with his marriage on the rocks, his career in trouble, and a financial life in free fall, he faced overwhelming challenges. And one day, driving on the narrow, twisting roads above Malibu, he asked himself, wouldn't it just be easier to end it all? That frightening question provoked a challenge for him to recapture his will and live a life where he would uncover just what it was that he was really living for. Jim, are you with us?
I sure am. Hi, Alan. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Let me bring you up just a little bit. Anyway, as I was saying, one of the things that was interesting is that we posed in a press release, we posed the question to our listeners and said, you know, what would you do, you know, with the last 24 hours of your life? And we had more people that not only gave us things that they would do, but we had people that called me personally or emailed and said, I just want to share the fact of how much courage that I think that this man has to bring up what they believe everybody thinks at some point in time in their life. And one person in particular said that they have thought it many times, but never really felt comfortable enough to share it. So,
well, I appreciate that. And you know, it is interesting because I have gotten a number of emails from people, and some have used the word brave. I have to be honest, though. I don't really consider it brave. I do consider it honest and liberating, because I do think that many people feel and think these thoughts and maybe feel alone or a sense of helplessness or hopelessness. And I think that many people, especially today, given the current economic climate, feel these things. And it's not something that folks feel comfortable talking about. But the sad part is that if you don't talk about it, the feeling of isolation only intensifies, and then you're much more likely to act out on it.
Well, yeah, and I certainly agree, and I think that you know, from the standpoint of some documentation that I've pulled up in regards to suicide, I was shocked to find out that suicide rates are up considerably. In fact, CNN reported that there's a John Hopkins studies that shows that after years of decline in the suicide rate in America, there's been a 3% annual increase in white men and 4% increase in white women ages 40 to 64 since 1969. Since 1999. But right now, with 10 to 15% unemployment prevailing in many cities, I think that figure may actually go up.
Sure, because those figures are lagging. They may lag by 6 months to a couple of years. And, you know, I think that we're going to see startling rises. And you know, the book starts from a very dark place, clearly. I mean, I was at about the lowest point you could be. But the book itself is about embracing life. And that's really why I asked myself that question, because that moment on that road could have very easily been the last day of my life. It could have been the last moment. And I made a couple of choices there. One was to continue to live. And then two, I chose how to live, how I would live. And it's, this is not a how-to book, certainly.
Right.
It's simply a memoir. But by posing the question, you know, I mean, I made a very concerted effort not to be on the cover in a picture, front or back of this book, because even though they're my stories, I think that a lot of people will hopefully relate to many of them, because I think everyone has dealt with loss and sadness and challenges. We all experience that, whether you make $20,000 a year or $2 million a year, and that doesn't matter, because we all share so many things in common. And you know, I'm really glad that I was able to write down my feelings, and my wife was so supportive. And I, you know, the first time she heard these thoughts were when she read that first chapter.
Wow.
She didn't realize, and
wow,
she cried, and she said, "Look, I don't care. You know, we were faced with losing our house." She said, "I don't care about our house. Mm-hmm. Our kids don't care about our house. We care about you." And those are things that I needed to hear, and they helped me focus on the real meaning in my life and the value. And that value had nothing to do with the amount on my bank statement. It had to do with the people that were in my life and the people that I had touched and who had touched me.
Well, walk us through your first tangible steps, because I think that's the toughest thing for anybody. I mean, the initial thing that you did just by making the decision, you know, not to do it and to shift your focus, I mean, I think that's great. But walk us through the first couple of tangible steps that got you in the right direction.
Well, for me, the first step was really the epiphany of that moment, where I realized that I could control more than I thought I could. And you know, it wasn't one moment where I was suddenly depressed. I mean, I think it had been building for a long time. Like many people, I was out of work for a couple of years. In broadcasting, it sometimes takes a while to get another job, and I relied on the equity of my home to keep me afloat. And I took out one of those loans that we've been reading about, and I unwittingly lit a time bomb that, ironically, was about to go off not when I was out of work, but after I was reestablished in my career. So I felt like I had no way out, because it wasn't as if I could say, well, if I get a job, everything will be fine. I had a great job, and I was still in trouble. So I thought, there's nothing I could do. I'm going to lose everything. And it, rather than what I would call a clinical depression or a chemical depression, I think I was experiencing a situational depression. But the fact is, depression's depression. I mean, you know, I fully support going to doctors, and some people need medication, and others need therapy. My therapy, in this particular instance, was the catharsis of writing. And it took me, oh, I guess about 7 months to really go through and mine my feelings. And without my wife, honestly, I don't know that I would be here, because she was so supportive and so loving. You know, I shared all of these feelings with her after she read that first chapter, which was originally intended as a journal just to myself. And she supported me and said, "I want you to keep writing, because you clearly need to do this. And I know that many of these stories will be personal to our family and to me, but do this with my blessing and encouragement." And, you know, I guess I had to get to a certain age in my life where I could look back and be honest. I make a living, as do you, by interviewing people.
Right.
And it's very, very difficult to interview yourself and be honest. And that's really the way I looked at this exercise. I looked at it as, where am I hurting? Because I was holding on to pain and anger and frustration and keeping a lot of feelings hidden, as most of us do. You know, you go along with your life and you try to support your family and do well for your kids, and sometimes we just bury things. And I buried a lot of feelings, and I felt shame and humiliation for the mistakes that I'd made, and I think a lot of people feel that. And it's hard to talk about those things, because frankly, you go to a dinner party and you say, gee, I'm really depressed about so-and-so. Nobody wants to hear that.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, that's why I think many people seek out therapy, because at least you know there's someone who will listen. Even if, and you're not necessarily even looking for someone to tell you the answers. You just need to get something off your chest, and that's what this was for me. So well, it was a months-long ordeal and process for me.
Well, and I love the thought, and I hadn't really thought of it that way, about interviewing yourself. I think that's great. And one of the things that I know that many of the kids that we work with, that we try to teach them, is the art of journaling. And I'm literally going to take that now and add to what it is that we try to talk to them about in regards to journaling. Is I want to tell them, interview yourself. I like that. So as you were interviewing yourself, you know, what did you end up really coming up with? I mean, you know, as you're interviewing yourself, I mean, this was then something you said, okay, this is now an interview that I need to get out to as many people as possible because maybe they aren't really doing it themselves?
Well, no, first it was literally just a journal. And I would say that I got to 100 pages before my wife said to me, Jim, this is a book. I think that other people will feel this way. I don't think you're alone. I think maybe you should keep going and consider putting this in the form of a book. Because what I did was, in asking myself that question, and, you know, I look at that moment on that cliff, really, as the moment in It's a Wonderful Life where Jimmy Stewart is on the bridge, and he's thinking about jumping, and Clarence, that angel, comes down and says, you know, are you sure you want to do this? And Jimmy Stewart says, I wish I'd never been born. Well, I didn't think that, but I did wonder, what would it be like if this were my last day? And so when I went home and finally got through that first dark period, I said, okay, so what do I value? And so I started writing down friendship and love and compassion and forgiveness and apology and tenacity. And none of the things that I was writing had anything to do with those things that were really causing me anxiety. It had nothing to do with money. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. This is really important to me. So I'd write about friendship. Mm-hmm. And I had lost a couple of very dear friends to illness, but they left me with something so meaningful and so wonderful. And the lessons that they taught me, I tried to write down and capture the spirit of what they had left me. And then, you know, I thought, well, what else is important? And then I spoke about, I'd made a couple of decisions putting family over career. When I was, you mentioned I was at CNN for 10 years, and I was anchoring two shows in Los Angeles, and after AOL took over Time Warner, there were budget cuts, and I was summoned back to Atlanta, where the headquarters is, and I was told, we're cutting back at the LA Bureau, and we're going to cancel your two shows, but we'd like you to move to Atlanta and anchor a morning show. Now, that was a great opportunity, but I told my boss, the then outgoing chairman, a guy named Tom Johnson, who was a wonderful man, I said, Tom, my wife and I have been separated for a few weeks, and I need to talk to you about this. Mm-hmm. And he closed the door and sat me down and said, Jim, nobody will care at the end of your life if you have another show on CNN. They're going to judge you by the kind of person you are, by the kind of husband, father. And so we have 2 years left on your contract, whatever it is. You are not moving. I will not allow you to do so. We'll pay you whatever we owe you, but you are staying home, and if you can fix this marriage, you fix it. And you're going to be sacrificing your career. Your career at the network is over, and it may damage you for some time, but this is what you have to do. And
wow.
He was right. It did damage my career, certainly ended it at CNN. Even though I'm now back as a contributor, it basically ended a wonderful career with that network. But the gift he gave me and the choice that I made, and I hadn't really reflected on it in a meaningful way until I was thinking of ending it all, was look what I got. I mean, instead of being married 17 years when we were separated, we've now celebrated our 27th anniversary.
Wow.
My wife and I are closer than ever. Our kids know that I chose them over my career. And it doesn't matter whether I can get them a new car next year or you know, or if they're driving a used car. They know that I am committed to them. And that's a gift, I think, far greater than anything I could write with a check.
Absolutely. And it's huge. And the timing, I think, is perfect in regards to this book, because we are talking to so many families out there that are having this same issue. You know, there's so many layoffs, there's so many foreclosures, there's all of these things, there's so much stress going on out there, and it's so difficult to make those decisions. And I just think this is perfect. And I think the advice that man gave you is just invaluable. That's great. And you had mentioned in regards to the way that your wife was so supportive in regards to the book. Early on, were your kids as supportive as well?
Well, I have a 23-year-old, a 20-year-old, and a 12-year-old. And the 12-year-old hasn't read the book. I just think it's just too much for, you know, at 12, I like to think that in some ways he still looks at me as a superhero, you know, and I think that there's only so much you can process at that age.
Right.
You know, my 23-year-old and 20-year-old, I talked to them at great length about it, and they both told me that they were really proud of me, and they both understood what I was writing and why, and even though I still think that's very young to fully appreciate, but let's face it, there are a lot of kids. I mean, I know of a lot of kids who have committed suicide in the last year for a number of reasons, a couple of them very prominent in the news recently. So it's not a subject that's foreign to them, but I think what was important for my kids to see is that their dad is vulnerable, just as all of us are, because we don't like to think of our parents in that way.
Right.
But I look at this book as my gift to them, because when I'm gone, they will have challenges, certainly, that I can't be there to help them with. But they will be able to read of my struggles and the fact that instead of giving up, I persevered. Sometimes I won, sometimes I came close, sometimes I didn't. But that I didn't give up. And I think that's the lesson. And also, what I consider valuable in my life, I'm hoping to pass on to them so that they don't look at, oh, gee, I want a new purse, I want a new car, I want a new house. Look, I love things. I'm not going to lie to you. I think everyone does.
Yeah.
But that's not what defines me. And that's my choice. You know, I don't care if somebody thinks I need a different pair of shoes. You know, I mean, hopefully they'll look at my character. They'll like me for what I am and who I am as opposed to what I'm wearing.
Right. Well, and you mentioned in regards to your kids, and I think that I may even tend to disagree a little bit. I think that they get it, and I think they get it at a very, very early age. And not only from what I've seen, but in fact, I have a particular story as a room dad for my son, and I'm trying to think of what grade he was in at that time, probably about fourth grade. And another boy in the class sitting next to me said, I wish my dad was retired like you. And I went, retired? what makes you think that I'm retired? And he said, well, how is it that you're able to be in this classroom once a week if you have a job? And I said, well, it's a conscious decision that I made that this is what was important to me. And I felt it was important to my boys. And he said, well, I wish that my dad could do that because he leaves for work before I get up in the morning. And he doesn't get home until after I get after I have to go to bed. So I really only see him on the weekends, and I wish that he could be here like you are. So you know, and this is in the fourth grade that you know he's getting it, that he understood that I was making a conscious decision. I may not make as much money, but that I felt it was important to be there. So I think even at a younger age, when you're making a decision like that, even if they don't know how to verbalize it, I think they get it, and it is important to them to understand, even at that age.
Well, and I share that with my 12-year-old, but I don't want him to think, you know, I don't want to frighten him and think that Dad thought about taking his life.
I gotcha.
Because that's something I don't know that he's really ready to listen to or comprehend, and I don't know that he needs to know that, you know? I think it's okay for him to know that there are challenges and that sometimes you can't get that new video game because we can't afford it. And there's nothing wrong with that. Or that maybe he doesn't need it. Or, you know, but that I'm there and that I do homework with him. And that if he has a question, he doesn't have to be afraid. But I certainly don't want him to feel any potential threat of abandonment. You know, those are issues I think that would be so difficult to process.
Well, and I think along those lines, we have a question that was emailed in, and let me read it as they sent it. It says, Mr. Cardoza, please ask your guest. It says, my father was seriously depressed over his illness when I was a teenager. He attempted suicide twice and threatened it several other times. I remember always feeling anxious, what seemed like all the time. Can you share with us the effects your depression may have had on your kids, or any other stories that you've received now that the book is out of people sharing with you?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think that, and that's what I'm talking about with my son. I think that no matter how old we are, I mean, my parents are still alive, and I talk to them every day. And I'm 53, you know, and the thought about losing your folks, even though that's the natural course of things, that parents die before their children, we don't want to think that they're going to leave us by decision, you know, making the conscious decision to say, I can't take this anymore, I'm leaving you. And I can certainly appreciate the anxiety. I think that since it was nothing that I'd threatened overtly or tried in a way that was like this writer talks about,
right,
that because I was honest with my kids and talked through it with them, I don't know that they experienced the anxiety or the fear that this would actually happen. But I know my wife did. I mean, when she read that chapter, because it was so difficult for me to say to her what I was thinking, she was terribly upset, terribly mm-hmm. upset. And thank goodness we talked about it. I mean, I think in situations like that, where somebody in your family or a friend is threatening suicide or telling you that they're thinking about it, I think that's where you have to step in. And even if they kick and scream, you have to intervene, literally, and refer them to somebody or make them talk to someone.
Right.
If not to you, then to a professional. I mean, when I talk about, you know, I was adopted at age 13. And
oh,
by
I didn't
my stepfather.
Know that. Mm-hmm.
And I still, you know, I knew my biological father. We had a relationship. But my mother and my father had decided that this was in all of our best interest. He had a family, I had a family, and it was easier to make a clean break. But that was something that I carried with me for years, feelings of abandonment and being upset about it. And it took me until my 50s to understand and to forgive my father, because I love him. And I know that what he did was he did out of love. But if he were to say he's going to take his life and leave me, you know, that's such a permanent...
Exactly, yeah.
Such a permanent action that you can't undo. I mean, fortunately, I'm able to have a relationship with my biological father, and I can tell him that I love him, and it doesn't matter if this adoption went through. But God forbid he took his life. I can't undo that.
Right. In fact, and I noticed, I mean, in the book, you have a chapter called Forgiveness. And in that point, and again, for the listeners, Jim's biological father is James Darren, the actor. And you write a little bit about that relationship with him. And as I said, it's called Forgiveness. As you were writing this, I mean, was that one of the things that sort of help the relationship, just from the standpoint of writing it and feeling the forgiveness?
It helped me, because it was clearly something that I'd been carrying around for years. And that's why I relate to my son at being 12 and thinking he's not ready to talk about certain things, because I was around his age when I was adopted. And, you know, that's such a pivotal age. Everything in your body is changing. You're going through puberty, you're going through all of these emotional upheavals in your life, you start to like girls, nothing makes sense, and then if you feel like you're losing touch with a member of your family, that stays with you, and I think in a profound way that I couldn't really appreciate until I was so much older and look back and say, well, you know, that really had an impact on me, and not mm-hmm. to the point where I would say, oh, look what he did, because, you know, my mother and my father, I think, did what they did out of love for me, and for whatever reasons they had, whether I understand them or not, I can still say to both of my mom and dad, you know what, you did something that you felt was best, I love you, and let's move on, and let's not keep it, you know, dragging us down, because I think it was a weight around my neck for a long time. So when I was being honest with myself, and I had to think about who would I forgive on that last day, you know, you often think about the deathbed confessional, right?
Right.
You always see that in the movie. Well, what a better time to do that on the last day, to finally say, not to ask anything in return, but to simply say to somebody, I forgive you, or I apologize to you, or I'm sorry, and really mean it. And I guess by doing that, you know, I used the last day as a, in a broader sense. If by looking at every day like your last day, you can start living in a different way. See?
Mm-hmm.
I hope I don't sound hokey.
No, not at all. But I'm going to take a break. I want to tell everybody we are speaking with Jim Mornay, and his book is The Last Day of My Life. I highly recommend it, and if you want to get it, you can probably get it most anywhere, but I know it's also on his website, which is www.jimmoret.com. It's JimMoret.com. We will be back in 1 minute and 15 seconds.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right. We're back, and we're talking about the book, The Last Day of My Life. Jim, I had a question in regards to wondering, are you the go-to person? Because I have talked with people that are sort of the go-to person in their family. In other words, they are the ones that whenever there's a problem in the family or with the friends, you're the one that they go to. And I'm wondering if you are that person, because I find, not only with myself but with other friends, is that if you are that go-to person, sometimes I think it's harder to share this information, because it almost feels like you're letting other people down when they go, wait a minute, he has some of the same thoughts I do.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think in many ways I am. I'm certainly the fix-it man at my house. You know what I mean? And if something goes wrong, well, Dad'll fix it. And I think that in a larger sense, that I'm still that person. You know, my folks will come to me, my wife's folks will come to me, my kids will come to me. And you're right. You when you reveal what you perceive as your own weaknesses, I think it surprises others. And certainly, I know with me, most people have said to me who know me, gosh, you're always so upbeat, you're always so happy. You're the last person that
right.
I thought would ever say something like this. And I think that the fact is, all of us have these feelings, whether you're an optimist or not. It doesn't mean you can't be beaten down every once in a while and have self-doubt and really wonder or question what you're doing here and why.
Right. Yeah. And where I think that by sharing it now, I think that the other people now feel more comfortable not only with sharing, but maybe with accepting. Because I think you have people that maybe if they're used to going to one person, they're not really expecting them to come back to them. And I think it probably helps that sort of give and take.
Alan, I think the interesting thing for me is the experience. I thought most people would perceive what I'd written as a sign of weakness. And instead, I think that what I've written has empowered me, because my life is an open book now. So I have nothing to hide. And when you remove the elements that you've hidden from the world, you also kind of take away those things that would otherwise embarrass you or cause shame. And I think that many of the feelings, you know, certainly if you're thinking about, gosh, I'm depressed, or I can't get a job, or how do I support my family, you know, there are feelings of shame and resentment and anger, and you just don't know where to turn. And if you can be honest and open about that, then at least you can remove the humiliation aspect of it and then work on a solution in a meaningful way.
Right, yeah, and I think you bring up a great point about the shame, especially, and you and I are from the same generation. You know, we were still brought up from the standpoint that you're measured based on bringing home the bacon. I mean,
sure.
That is the way that you're measured. And and we don't know anything that different. I mean, obviously, you know, this new generation, it's changing, it's growing, it's getting much more, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but I mean, it's there isn't as much pressure that's your primary duty and that is your measuring point. And I think being able to share it now sort of it takes a little bit of that away. It's not so much a pressure, which I think is great.
And frankly, living in Los Angeles, I think it's hard to ever feel successful because there's so much excess and opulence here. And, you know, I cover, routinely I cover entertainment programs and the Oscars and the Grammys and the Golden Globes. And you've never seen more in terms of wealth and or certainly outwardly. And, you know, it's very difficult to feel like a success if you grow up in that environment. I think that all of us still want to feel like we're important to those around us. And I think that's really what I was trying to get back to with my own life, really kind of value my life in terms of the relationships as opposed to the dollars.
Right. And I think that's a great message to adults and teens alike, because you know, not only are you looking at that, but that's what teens, especially in Southern California, are growing up with as well. If the teens' parents are in this industry, they're seeing that. And that's got to be a huge burden to look at that and go, you know, how else, I mean, how can I feel successful if this is what I'm looking at? These are the same teens that you know we're dealing with, and we're taking them to drug and alcohol rehab programs because rather than deal with those feelings, they're covering them up. They're masking them with drugs, alcohol, or whatever their particular issue is.
And think about how sad that is, that they feel that they have to do that.
Right, and they can't just sort of rejoice in the fact of what they do have. I mean, you know, if you think about it as in comparison to the rest of the world, someone like yourself who has traveled the world, you know, if they look at it, if they could just look at it and see, you know, in comparison to what just about anybody else on the planet has, they have got so much going for them and so many opportunities to do anything they want, but yet to then find a negative in that, you're right, is really sad.
And, you know, as a result of this experience, and I put in my book, I go through a daily mantra, basically. And I look in the mirror, and I use that time when I'm shaving, but I look in the mirror and say out loud those things that I'm really grateful for. And by saying it out loud, I have to hear my voice. So I'm actually concentrating on it. And I'm grateful for my family, my kids, my wife, our marriage, the fact that we have our parents, the fact that we've had so many wonderful opportunities. And then I go down this list, the C words, I call them, calm, cool, connected, compassionate, comical. You can choose your own words. I always end on the word centered. And I close my eyes, take a breath, and then I'm ready to face the day. And I find that by really focusing on positive things, things that I'm grateful for, it changes my entire day. It really does, as opposed to waking up. Today's Monday. It's easy to say, oh, gosh, I can't believe it's Monday. I have to go to work. You know, how many times have you said that? Especially on Sunday night, you're going, oh, I can't believe I have to go to work tomorrow. And you know, when you go through the day with a negative attitude, it all gets reflected back. And if you go through the day, conversely, with a positive attitude, that energy is reflected back, and it shapes your experience in a wholly different way. So, you know, you can control certain things. You can't control if, and again, I'm not suggesting that money has no importance. I'm not at all.
Right.
But I am suggesting that we put too much importance on it. And if we really look at the things that we have, and you mentioned what we have in this country, I was down at Acapulco last week covering the violence during spring break.
Mm-hmm.
And you look around, and there are a lot of college kids there with clearly a lot of money. And the area around the city, there's not a lot of money, and you come home with a new appreciation of what we do have. Even if we don't have the latest 60-inch plasma TV, you live a pretty great life here in this country, and you have to remember what you've got.
Absolutely. And at some point in time after this, we're going to have to get together and share C words. When you said that, I got a big smile because I have a couple of mantras that I do as well, and one of them is all C words. So
why is it that, you know, it's funny because I was going through words and I could come up with so many positive words that begin with C. I don't know why. That's interesting you had that same experience.
Yeah, yeah. So, and it's something that I've done even like since the children were born, since my boys were born. And one of the mantras that I did was saying them, saying their name. So it would go something like this, and it would be, I am Chase. I am happy, healthy, and secure. I am loved. I deserve love. I have the ability to give love and receive love. And then I have another one, which would be, I am Blaze. I am confident. I am creative. I am charismatic. And I just go through a variety of C words. So anyway, yeah, at some point in time, we're going to have to share C words.
How wonderful. And you share that with your kids.
Yeah, I share it. And from the time in which they were born, that was the whole thing, is I would do that, and I would use their name so that it would focus in their mind as it's their name. They're saying to themselves, I am, and then they're going into it so that it would continually foster in their mind that this is who they are, and that they can be anybody that they choose to be, which is another one of the mantras that I go into. But
that's wonderful. That really is. It's so empowering for them, and it must make them feel so special and so loved. And think about that for a moment. That costs you nothing in terms of money, but what does it give you in terms of riches? Think about how enriched they are because you've said those things to them and meant it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's really beautiful.
Now, what do you think is the biggest message that you want readers to be able to get from this? And I think we're talking about it right now, but what are some of the other things that you really would like to see them get? Because, again, as I've said, the timing of this, I mean, as soon as I found out about this book, I contacted my producer and I said, please, can you get Jim for this? Because this is perfect. This is at an exact time, in America that this is what we need.
Well, I appreciate that. That's very nice of you. And I think this is not a how-to book, and I really stress I don't tell people how to live, but I am sharing how I chose to live. And the key word there is choice, really. I've discovered in myself the power to choose. I chose first to live. I mentioned this earlier, and then I chose how I would live. And when you're faced with challenges, my wife and I, for example, are putting our house on the market in about 2 or 3 weeks because we've hit the wall. And, we're trying to do everything in as easy a way as possible, but it is a difficult experience. And the challenges have continued. Some have intensified since I wrote this book. But the difference is my perspective. I won't assign importance to certain things where they don't deserve it, because I know the riches that I have in my life. I'm focusing on those things for which I'm grateful. I'm looking at friendship and love and family and compassion and commitment and apology. And all of those chapters that I wrote have a much greater meaning to me than where I'm going to live or how much money I'm going to make. And, I constantly have to tell myself and refocus. I'll give you a quick example, too, and what we take for granted. One of the chapters I write about is called Miracles, because about a year ago, our son was misdiagnosed with a broken ankle and was put in a cast. Turns out he didn't have a broken ankle, and the cast caused a compression of the nerve in his foot, and he developed something called complex regional pain syndrome. And it's basically the nerve is sending a signal to the brain telling the brain that the foot is in extreme pain. Wow. And the foot was swollen. And anyway, it was horrible. We had to go through MRIs and doctors. It's very difficult to diagnose. It's very rare. After a couple of months, we found a wonderful team at UCLA, and they cured him. And for a year, our son was perfect. He was a great 11- and 12-year-old kid. Well, in January, almost to the day that my book came out, he had a relapse, and he has not been to school since before Christmas.
Wow.
And he can't walk, he can't touch his foot. He's being homeschooled now through the school. And I thought to myself, I wrote this chapter on miracles because I really believe miracles can and do happen. But even in that 1 year when our son was fine, I think I took that for granted. I took for granted the fact that he could walk. I took for granted the fact that he could sit and not be in pain while we just talked or watched TV or played a game. And you know what? I got another lesson in January, as did our son. You can't take that for granted. So I'm taking nothing for granted. And so that's something that I have to tell myself every day. Take nothing for granted. Embrace every day. And if you look at every day as if it's your last, every day that follows will still be a better day.
That's great. Yeah, and it's a real focus on appreciation. So yeah, absolutely. Now, I would imagine you probably had a lot of people, because of the book, that are sharing with you what they would do on their last day. We got some emails that came in, so I want to share a couple of those because I appreciate the fact that they did. One of them comes from someone who says that, I live in New York City. If I knew that it was the last 24 hours of my life, I would fly to Germany with my daughter and spend the time with my parents at their home.
Oh, how see now and
how simple,
you know,
is that?
If you asked me what I would do on my last day, it would be as seemingly mundane as that, because I would, you know, I look at the moments. My wife loves to needlepoint. You know what? Sometimes we'll be in bed, I'll be watching TV, and we won't even be speaking, but just being next to her when she's doing something she loves makes me feel good. And I play guitar. I do certain things with my kids that are specific to them. You know, nothing fancy. Nothing. It would be boring to most people, but it's so meaningful to me. And think about going to Germany, not because it's Germany, but because his parents are there, and spending that last day with his folks.
Exactly.
How wonderful is that?
Right. It comes back to that same focus of family. So this person is, they're taking their daughter with them. I'm assuming they only have one child, but
let's hope that that's the case.
But you know, they're taking their daughter with them and they're spending it with their parents. And but it doesn't say, which one of the things I liked, it doesn't say, you know, I'm gonna go, you know, I'm gonna go jump on an airplane. I'm gonna go race a car. You know, I'm gonna do, you know, some of those things. Which there was a couple of emails that came in and said that they're going to go. One said that, you know, they would go race a car. You know,
and you know what? That's certainly valid too. That's more akin to what you would call a bucket list, I guess. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you want to share. You know, many people's last days would include an adventure, and there's nothing wrong with that either, because sometimes when you think time's running out, you don't want to ever think, gosh, I wish I had done this.
Shoulda, coulda, woulda.
We're very seldom upset that we've done something, but we're much more upset that we haven't.
Absolutely. So we've got about five more minutes. Have you had other people that have shared things, and if so, what are some of those?
The things that people have shared, interestingly enough, are not so much what they would do their last day, but they have said, you know, I've lost someone, and I felt guilty about this. Or, you know, I felt like I was alone. Thank you, because you're putting a voice to something that people don't want to talk about, but I think many people are experiencing. It's that type of feeling. And I think that it makes me feel so grateful that the book could touch somebody, even in the smallest way, that they would feel comfortable to share with me, a total stranger, the fact that they had experienced some of the same anguish and hopelessness, and that they made it through as well. One person in particular had lost his wife, and he'd lost his job. He crawled into a bottle of alcohol basically for 10 years or so, and recently decided to reclaim his life, and he wanted to share that with me. And he had read my book, and in some way it touched him. And you know what? It made me feel so happy that I've been able to connect with people that I would never know otherwise and who would not know me. I think that this has made me, you know, I talk about being a reporter and an interviewer. I've always been mindful of the fact that when I interview somebody, they or their family will see that report on TV. And I try to be respectful of them. Even if you ask what is ostensibly a difficult question, because sometimes when you interview somebody, depending on the story, you do. But I think this has made me more empathetic and more compassionate. And so even in writing my feelings, I think it's changing me in a profound way as I move forward, because I'm much more empathetic toward others' pain, even though I thought I was pretty empathetic before.
Yeah. Well, and I think also what I got from it is that I got the part about appreciation, gratitude, appreciation, but I also can envision people finding this book that are maybe thinking about it themselves and being able to read this book and say, you know what? I do have a lot to live for. I do have a lot that I should be appreciative of. And maybe that person will make a decision, obviously first not to take their own life, but maybe to go out and get some counseling, maybe go out and talk to a professional and move forward with their own life. And that's,
I've had that experience with a couple of people, and one
please
person,
share
I,
with
I, rec- I recommended to this person that they speak to somebody. I said, you know, I'm not qualified. I'd love to talk to you. And I did. I spoke to them and I said, you need to talk to somebody. And I actually arranged for them to meet with someone. And they've now been seeing this person, this therapist, a couple of times a week. And it's apparently having a really positive, meaningful difference in their life. And you're right. I mean, the fact is that I feel the book is a tremendous success because I know that I touched one person.
Right.
And I know that can sound trivial and say, oh, well, that's not true. And it really is true because I did this for myself. And, you know, the wonderful benefit is that it's actually touching other people as well. I didn't do this thinking, oh, great, I'm going to make $1 million on a book. This was something that I had to do. And for someone to say thank you because, you know, you steered me in another direction and I now have hope where I didn't before. What more wonderful thing can you imagine hearing? That's how I feel. I'm just so grateful.
You know, that may be the next book. You tell everybody that's out there reading this book, send in how it's affected you.
I love that. Well, you know what? And honestly, you know, I'm not qualified certainly as a therapist. I'm trained as a lawyer and a reporter, but I cannot tell you how many stories that I've covered that deal with death and tragedy. And often, just as doctors do in an emergency room, you have to put up a veneer, a wall. And when that wall comes down, because you're the person who's experiencing the loss, wow, I tell you, if you don't have someone to reach out to, you can just feel such despair that it's overwhelming. And I think that the fact that I've written this and people know, hey, you can be on TV, you can feel this way, you can be an auto worker, you can be a doctor, you can be anything, and still have these profound feelings of loss and despair. And that's part of the human condition, and it's nothing to be ashamed of.
No, not at all. In fact, it's actually very beautiful, you know, to be able to share like this and affect people's lives in such a positive way. I gotta tell you, we're just about running out of time, and I know that you and you have to go on the air anyway, so I know that you're gonna go on, I guess, probably in about 12 minutes here. Again, let me just share with everybody, you know, the book is The Last Day of My Life. You know, you can get it probably anywhere, you know,
Amazon, Barnes and Noble.
Amazon, Barnes and Noble. Yeah, all of them. And actually, I should tell you, maybe we should try to task you to put your C words on your website.
I will. I'll be happy to. I will do that today.
Yeah. And maybe I'll try to shoot some over as well. I look forward to talking to you again. I've really appreciated this, and I really, again, can't thank you enough for putting this book out at a time in American history in which I think we need it most.
Alan, you've started my week on such a wonderful note. I really appreciate the fact you had me on. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, I got to tell you, that was a pleasure for me. Being able to talk to Jim, what a great message that he's got out there. And also, I want to thank everybody out there for the emails that I'm getting. I got some very positive emails, not only in regards to this, but some of the other shows. And I would just want to share that, you know, these positive emails and positive phone calls, you know, many of which are success stories from families who have had a teen, you know, that has graduated from, you know, from a different program. It may be that we transported them. It may be that we didn't. And although I happen to be the one on the microphone, it is, you know, the authors out there writing books like this. It's the educational consultants. It's the therapists, the specialized program personnel out there. If you're listening or not, they're the ones that are dedicating their time to the service of others. For that, I thank you, all of you that are making a difference to better lives, in the young people and hoping to improve our next generation. So again, I thank you all. Have a great week, and I will be on the air this time next week. Take care now. Bye.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.